Welcome to the House of the Risen Sun with Bruce Rawls and Lynn Johnson. And Bruce is on the line with me this morning. How are you doing this morning, Bruce?
I'm just great, Lynn. Thank you. And yourself?
I'm doing wonderfully. How's the weather out there on the Oregon coast?
A little cool and overcast, but the usual, you know.
Yeah. That'd be nice. I guess our weather is on fire, so.
Yeah, I've been kind of watching little excerpts of crazy weather around the country, so, yeah.
Yep, so, but there we are. And that is living in the world. Let's see, what did I just do? I just lost my bookmark. All right. So Bruce and I have been reading from the lifetimes when Jesus and Buddha knew each other, A History of Mighty Companions. And I just got a notice on Facebook the other day, my 10-year Facebook friendiversary with Gary Renard. And I was like, oh, my God, 10 years on Facebook.
That's
That, I knew him for 3 or 4 years before that. And it just amazes me that, you know, all this time, Gary Renard has been such a huge figure in my life. And now we're reading through this book and he's working on a new one. And, you know, what an interesting character in my dream.
Oh, same here. I had a wonderful conversation synchronistically with Gary and Cindy yesterday, and we made a recording, a 30-minute recording on forgiving our projections, which is really about forgiving the projector. And both Gary and Cindy shared it for about 15 minutes, and just wonderful stuff. That'll be part of the Miracle Share conference happening in October 2018 here. So I just and then afterwards I chatted with him for a bit and kind of caught up on things, and so anyway, it's always a joy to talk with them, and their sharing is always just so right on and true to the course, and always appreciated, and full of insight and humor and levity. So
yeah, exactly. Yeah. I love it. Yeah. That is one thing with Gary, always the humor. And what a joy that is. The same thing with Ken. Ken was just total humor. He was always joking and so affectionate to people. And gosh, you know, is there something about this Course in Miracles that just makes people funny and nice and sweet and loving and kind? I don't know.
I think it's spelled out there pretty clearly in a few places. But basically by a counterexample, and certainly with when we remembered not to laugh at the tiny mad idea. You know, that's pretty clear that we're supposed to be not in any kind of shaming us into, but just kind of like. You know, if we're taking it seriously, something's gone wrong, because there's nothing here to take seriously. It's just a silly misconception. And, the belief that separation was possible is really the only thing we need to look at. And then once we look at it with the Holy Spirit, with our inner kindness teacher, that light dissolves and vaporizes that misunderstanding. And we're just left with a smile and a laugh, and we're on our way back.
Yeah, a little embarrassed giggle, like whoop.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and it's not like a heavy-handed kind of thing. It's just like, wow, we just turned down a cul-de-sac and spent how many lifetimes there instead of just putting the thing in reverse and backing it up, meep, 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 and then putting it in drive and getting out of that cul-de-sac,
Just get out.
Really?
The cul-de-sac is a lot of fun unless you're just stuck there and you're just going around and around in circles. So,
I like how Martin and Persa classify it. It's really a not so merry-go-round. if we're honest with ourselves, the world as we've painted it, the picture we've painted as egos, is really not a joyous place. And it's really the only joy that we find in it is what we bring to it from that more sane thought system. And I think that's a lot of what, of course, Miracles is helping us do, is to look at how, by default, if we identify with the insanity of the separate self, there's no fun to be found in that. There's no joyousness. There's no peace. And, it's the hell that we made. And, but it's not a real hell. And we don't know that until we look at it with that awareness we took with us into the dream, huh?
Well, yeah, and it's so funny because the what the ego takes pleasure in is agony. The ego takes pleasure in seeing people suffer. The ego takes pleasure in becoming a victim. The ego takes pleasure in teasing and taunting people in situations that seem would be unbearable to the mind. If you were thinking clearly, you would lose your mind about these things. You would be brokenhearted when you see the world the way that it is right now. So, but the ego takes great pleasure. You know, I see it myself. You know, I turn on the TV and I see, you know, all these, you know, indictments coming up against all these people with Trump and all this stuff. I go, oh, good, they're going to get theirs now. Boy, we're going to really get some vindication now. We're going to right the wrongs of the world now. The pleasure that the body, the mind experiences from that thought of revenge is so visceral, and yeah, you would never, I mean, nobody would ever admit, or very few people would ever admit, that really excites me. I'm really happy to see bad things happening to these people. You know, I mean, it just sounds so crazy.
And the only way that can be justified is if the basic premise is never questioned. Which is, and that premise is that the essence of our existence is guilt, but we never look at it that way. And the other part that, you know, must remain hidden from the ego's thought system is the whole notion of projection. Because that, if we really look at projection, which is why I sort of hinted. We put the Miracle Share Conference for this fall together. It's like, that's a pretty hefty topic because it covers so much ground. You know, if we just look at the nature of projection and how we believe that we made up, we made up a world because of our belief that we pulled off this cosmic separation act. We think that we were actually able to act independently of our creator as separate, autonomous, independent creatures. And as of Course in Miracles reminds us, the only way that's possible is in a dream. And so, but we don't get that here. That's not our everyday experience. And we have to really train our minds to undo that insane thought system, which, as you say, you know, revels in and delights in, the agony, because we feel that's what everyone deserves, including ourselves. And that's why, you know, the projection factor is really something that is such an important concept, that, you know, ideas don't leave their source. And when we're seeing someone squirm in anguish, we're basically saying, that's what I deserve. And that's because we think on some bizarre level of the mind that we pulled off this impossible crime, and we believe it was possible, and as a result of that misconception, our secret sins and hidden hates, you know, with that projected guilt then surfaces in those kinds of furtive guilty pleasure, oxymorons really, but that crazy making stuff that we when we look at it, just like insane. Why would anyone find pleasure at anyone's misfortune or discomfort or pain of any sort, right? And pain is a mental process, as Gary's teachers point out, and it's not a physical process.
Yeah, it's, yeah, and you know, it's just funny to me because you know, look at what we generally find as humor. And, you know, thinking about, you know, the Three Stooges or the, you know, any look at any movie that would be considered humorous, Dumb and Dumber. You know, people laugh about this stuff. And what it is, every single thing that you're laughing at is some terrible thing, some tragedy that happens. You know, somebody slips and falls on a banana peel. You know, people are so stupid they don't know, you know, they get themselves embroiled in these crazy situations. And we laugh and laugh and laugh at, you know, what are we laughing at? Ignorance, lack of ability. We're laughing at these things that anybody with a brain or, you know, with a brain, anybody with a sense of compassion would be going, oh my God, you know, stop that. Don't, you know, this is not good. You know, let's be kind. Let's not do stupid things. You know, compassion would tell you not to laugh at these things, but the mind, the ego says, this is hilarious. And is it funny? You know, is it really what we want to laugh at? Or are we laughing really at the silly notion that these things could actually happen? And that's, you know, maybe the truth. I don't know. But I think you had something in your mind.
Oh, I always do. As you do, too. And what crosses my mind as you're talking about, you know, the types of, you know, the subjects for fitting for humor. And certainly there's plenty of slapstick out there. I find kind of the more cerebral stuff more interesting usually. And in particular, a couple things came to mind as you're sharing that. I was thinking, well, two things where we can gently laugh at ourselves, you know, in terms of our projections, you know, a couple of classic scenes that probably most people will, well, some people will be familiar with both of these, I think, perhaps. One is in the movie Blazing Saddles, where the mean hombres are about ready to ransack and pillage and loot the town, and they're all on horseback going through the desert, and all of a sudden they discover this toll booth, and in the classic scene where Slim Pickens, you know, says, anybody got a dime? And because the toll bridge, you know, arm goes down just as they approach the gate there, and of course there's hundreds of miles in either direction so they could just go around this thing, right? But that's the folly, is that we think that we have to, you know, impose these restrictions on ourselves, but they're all unnecessary. And I think that's the point, is that, you know, we all do this to ourselves. You know, anyway, Slim Pickens' character says, "Dan, now we got to go back and get us a whole shitload of dimes." You know, and of course, I'm not doing it justice the way he said it, but you know, it's that kind of humor. It's like we do this to ourselves, and if we can just, you know, gently laugh at ourselves, not in a derisive or mean spirit, just kind of look at all the things that we do in the course of a day, or even an hour. You know, we probably come up with a half dozen pretty easily if we just kind of look at the thoughts that we have about ourselves and each other that are not the kindest things possible. And just say, wow, there I am. I'm making a toll bridge or a toll booth or whatever in my mind where, you know, I'm restricting access to the freedom that I really want by imposing an artificial structure where one needs not belong and where it's easy enough to just trust my guidance and go around the thing, you know. The other example was a Monty Python skit that's one of my favorites, where it's El Magnifico and Janet, and he's this magician hypnotist who basically has put up an entire multi-story building of flats by hypnosis. And he's up there on one of the top floors with one of the residents, and he says, the only problem is when the residents catch on that it's done by hypnosis and stop believing in it, then the whole building starts to waver, and you can see it, you know, the things start shaking in the camera, you know, they just move the camera, of course, to make it look like it's the building starting to collapse, but then he goes in and re-hypnotizes them to remind him that, oh yeah, it's really there, you know, you're really living in a building, but you know, what a great metaphor for this artificial, you know, residence that we call space-time. And we don't have El Magnifico hypnotize us, you know, every so, you know, once every year or two. We do it, you know, millions of times per second with,
yeah,
with the feedback that we put there. We planted those props on the stage of our mind to give us the feedback that reinforces our decision for the unconscious skill. And that's again, another powerful concept in A Course in Miracles that suggests that, you know, the illusion, it's all illusion as Eastern mysticism suggests, but its purpose of it basically is there to reinforce the unconscious guilt until we look at it with our inner kindness teacher, with Holy Spirit, and say, wow, this whole thing is just a scam. I mean, it's not, as Ken Wapnick says, evil, sinful, or wicked. It's just silly. And it's just, it's like a giant, you know, skyscraper put up by hypnosis. And yeah, if we stop believing in it, it's going to start to waver a bit. But we don't have to panic. We just need to just realize, you know, we've never been there. You know, it's this, and we can afford to gently laugh and do the normal things and have, you know, fun in our lives and you know, but experience all the craziness from the vantage point of the awareness we took with us into the dream that really is outside of the dream of time and space and larger, if you want to use that word, than the cosmos itself that as we imagine it. So anyway, enough on
this.
Alexis Mel Brooks and Monty Python here.
There we go. Saturday morning. We got our...
two of my favorites, of course. But...
Me too. Absolutely. So we're going, let's look at the book. We decided to go back and reread the section called The Correction of Error, which Art and Persa had suggested to Gary to read. And Persa says, it's absolutely vital to every student's fast progress. Without it, there would be nothing but delay. And so I guess I'll go ahead and start reading.
Sure, please.
Okay. The Correction of Error. This is Gary is reading this. The alertness of the ego to the errors of other egos is not the kind of vigilance the Holy Spirit would have you maintain. Egos are critical in terms of the kind of quote-unquote sense they stand for. They understand this kind of sense because it is sensible to them. To the Holy Spirit, it makes no sense at all. To the ego, it is kind and right and good to point out errors and quote-unquote correct them. This makes perfect sense to the ego, which is unaware of what errors are and what correction is. Errors are of the ego, and probably the biggest... And correction of errors.
Whoops.
Lies in the relinquishment of the ego. When you correct a brother, you are not telling him that he is wrong. He may be making no sense at the time. Or when you correct the brother, you are telling him that he is wrong. He may be making no sense at the time. It is certain that if he is speaking from the ego, he will not be making sense. But your task is to tell him he is right. You do not tell him this verbally if he is speaking foolishly. He needs correction at another level because his error is at another level. He is still right because he is the Son of God. His ego is always wrong, no matter what it says or does. And let me just stop right there because that's it. The ego is always wrong. The ego is always wrong. The ego is never right.
which is to say, if we then reel in the projections, and there's nobody out there, my ego is always wrong. My ego is never right. But the way out of that seemingly hopeless realization is to realizing my ego never existed, which means that my projection of ego never existed. So there's no one out there to correct. There's no one inside to correct. Only if I look at that with Holy Spirit, whose judgment is fair and equitable to everyone, because he doesn't see, he recognizes our error, but it's kind of straddling the two thought systems, but in a sense, but only to the extent that necessary to realize that we're seeing an illusion, and because of the perspective of that awareness that of what we really are, we call Holy Spirit or inner kindness teacher or Jesus as a symbol that the Course uses, that awareness sees that innocence is the only reality. And anything less than that is not worthy of our identification, not worthy of our dwelling upon. We have to notice that we've chosen incorrectly, and you can't get out of the cul-de-sac unless you see that you're there and then back out. But at the same time, that detour is really a fantasy. That detour is an illusion. That, because what we really are is we're already back, you know, on the highway. We're using that metaphor, or we've always been home. We never left perfect oneness. So it's only from that perspective that we can see that our brother is right, not because of you know, what's happening or not happening in the dream with our brother or sister or ourself, but as we think of our lowercase s selves, but only because what we really are is not any of those dream figures.
Exactly. Right? Exactly. And that's what, you know, I read someone the other day was posting, someone asked a question, and it's a teacher, a Course in Miracles teacher, and they were asking about Trump, and this person said, well, Trump is the Christ. And I looked at that, and I thought, well, that's not true. No character is the Christ. And I think people make a lot of confusion about that, trying to turn this character into the Christ, trying to imagine this character as the Christ. And it's beyond the character. It's beyond the ego. You know, you're looking at the ego through the ego, which is what, you know, Jesus is talking about here. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's like saying, Lynn will become enlightened. That's impossible.
Mm-hmm. Oxymoron. Yeah, as you're saying that, Lynn, it reminds me that you know, I think it's important to remember and to restate, you know, periodically, that we use the word Jesus as a symbol for an awareness in our mind that we took with us into the dream that is our way out of the dream. That's basically the string into the cave that we tied around our waist and then on one end and tied to the entrance to a tree at the entrance of the cave on the other end. And, you know, that's, you know, it becomes a dark thread as we follow ego's, you know, insanity further into the darkness. But if we turn it around and, you know, start gently pulling on it the other way, and we can find ourselves, you know, reeling it in, we can find ourselves eventually at the opening of the cave. It becomes a golden thread. It gets brighter and brighter as we, you know, get, you know, return from the seeming darkness. But that symbol is just a symbol. That awareness that we call Jesus is just a symbolic placeholder for an idea in the mind. Just as Bruce and Lynn and whoever else is listening to this, the names that we apply to those and the bodies and the personas and their stories, both the physical and the psychological selves with the lowercase s, are all fiction. They're all made up stories that we've told ourselves. And so even to say, you know, Jesus Christ is an oxymoron. If by Jesus you mean, and this is certainly important to take in the right context, a body or a person that walked on planet Earth at a particular time in Earth's history, you know, just as the Bruce and Lynn characters are equally fictional. And that's the whole point of this curriculum, which to me is, you know, kind of ties into, you know, Gary and Cindy and their future selves / teachers, Arden and Persa. You know, people sometimes say, well, you know, are those ascended masters real? Well, in terms of the reality of the one spirit that we all share, of course. But in terms of separate figures that appear in the dream, no. How could anything that appears in space-time that is a representative of the thought system of separation be real? I mean, there's no way that's possible. But it certainly flies in the face of what our world considers common sense, because we're so based on our senses and we're so immersed and entrenched in believing that, you know, it has to be something that has sensory verification, which of course modern physics says is, you know, not possible, only because, you know, quantum mechanics basically dashed all of that kind of stuff to the rocks decades ago. But anyway, so once again, I digress, but hopefully that's helpful.
Oh, it is helpful. It is helpful because one of the major conundrums that people go through is this vacillation between, you know, what am I? What am I? What am I? And this belief in ourselves as being a spiritual being, living a human life or living in a human body, that is not even the case at all either, because that is not actually happening. It is imagining, we're listening and imagining and making up a story. All of this is a story right now. I'm in the middle of a story and you're in the middle of a story. And it's not a whole story that everyone experiences as one. It is my particular point of view of that story, just as your point of view of the story is a different thing altogether. And what is the key that Jesus has given us is to see the sameness in everything and everyone, to see the sameness in every situation, and to recognize as I was watching Westworld the other night, and the character who's the, like, runs the server, basically, says, you know, they've been analyzing all these humans that have come in there for over the years, millions of humans, and they come to realize that there are only certain very few actual stories. There are very few actual human experiences. And so the only thing that makes them any different one from the other is the details that we put into it through our own imagination. So, you know, you have the story of you're born, you live, you die. You know, in between of that, you have, you know, romances, or, you know, shoot 'em ups with robots, or whatever it is that you do during that lifetime. But it's very small variations. It's not really like some hugely different, you know, Elon Musk is doing something totally different than Bruce Rawls is doing. No, it's basically all the same robotic over and over and over situation and experiences, and we make up the details, and the details are what give it life, and the details are what make it real to us, and the details are what make it memorable to us, and the details are what makes our experience seem whole. But we're the ones making it up, you know, and so, you know, it's hard. Like I said, you know, the ego can't see the ego for what it is. It believes that it is the thing that I am. And I recognize that my fascination with that thing and its life and its experiences and its stories is what keeps me caught up in the dream.
Yeah.
That's it. It's my fascination. I love it.
It's very hypnotic and mesmerizing, but it's just, you know, a massive dream, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's crazy, and you know, to say I want to waken up, I don't want to be sleeping, I want to know the truth. Well, it's right here, right now. You can know it right here, right now, but you have to give up wanting the other thing. You can't have both. You know, either I want the dream or I don't. And I can't have the dream and reality at the same time. And so, you know, I guess, you know, reality right now is not as alluring to me as the story in the dream, you know, because I choose the story in the dream so often. But that's what this whole course is here to help me understand, is that the world beyond that, the peace of God that's shining in me now, beyond this world is the world I want. That world is really what I want. But I don't see that world. I only see this world. So, you know, there's another shift that has to happen in order for me to see that world enough to want it.
And that takes mind training, huh?
Yeah, it does.
Practice.
Practice. So you want to read if you point out the
errors? Sure.
Okay.
Sure. If you point out the errors of your brother's ego, you must be seeing through yours, because the Holy Spirit does not perceive his errors. This must be true, since there is no communication between the ego and the Holy Spirit. The ego makes no sense, and the Holy Spirit does not attempt to understand anything that arises from it. Since he does not understand it, he does not judge it, knowing that nothing the ego makes means anything. When you react at all to errors, you are not...
Just a minute. Let's just stop back here.
Okay.
The Holy Spirit doesn't see error. The Holy Spirit doesn't perceive the things that are going wrong. The Holy Spirit is not privy to the mistakes that my mind is making with the ego. But the Holy Spirit doesn't even attempt to understand anything from the ego. And so the Holy Spirit is, I know people, and I know I do it all the time. I say, you know, Holy Spirit, look at this with me. Holy Spirit, let me see this differently. But am I invoking the Holy Spirit to look at my error? Or am I invoking my right mind to see it differently?
It's really the question of purpose. And the intention that determines which teacher is being called. And we have to be honest. You know, Jesus says in his course, you know, we must be very honest with each other. And as Ken points out, it says it's not likely that Jesus is being deceptive. So he's basically saying it's up to you. It's up to each of us to really be honest with what we're thinking every moment, and just say, if I'm not at peace, I must have chosen the wrong teacher, because the teacher that really is going to help me. It's not that there's no perception going on. I mean, I think the Holy Spirit, in a sense, you know, like you say, doesn't deal with the specifics, but it knows when there's a gap in the recording, so to speak, when there's a dropout in the awareness of our reality. That's because we've made an interpretation that the ego has handed us into something that, you know, seems real, but there's no reality to it. And so we need that awareness to remind us that anything that involves differences as being important, anything that involves anything less than perfect innocence for everyone, is obviously a derailment of you know, the the fast track that A Course in Miracles has put us on by our choice.
Exactly. Wow. Okay. Well, I'll continue reading.
Okay. Let's see. When you react at all to errors, you are not listening to the Holy Spirit. He has merely disregarded them. And if you attend to them, you are not hearing him. If you do not hear him, you are listening to your ego and making as little sense as the brother whose errors you perceive. This cannot be correction. Yet it is more than merely a lack of correction for him. It is the giving up of correction in yourself. When a brother behaves insanely, you can heal him only by perceiving the sanity in him. If you perceive his errors and accept them, you are accepting yours. If you want to give yours over to the Holy Spirit, you must do this with his. Unless this becomes the one way in which you handle all errors, do I hear the word generalization nearby? You cannot understand how all errors are undone. How is this different from telling you that what you teach, you learn? Your brother is as right as you are, and if you think he is wrong, you are condemning yourself. Bingo. You want to read more?
Sure. And it's just how important that is to remember that.
Oh,
that,
yeah.
If I'm thinking my brother is wrong, then I'm wrong.
Yep.
You know, basically that's it. You know, and you know, then it comes to how much am I willing to defend my idea that I'm right? You know, I'm not even going to listen to the Holy Spirit or Jesus and say, yep, I'm wrong. I'm going to say, yeah, but I am right because this and this and this and this. And I have all these justifications, and I justify it through love. Oh, love would never allow this to happen. Someone who is caring would never do a thing like this. You know, I use love as a weapon to, you know, I love the earth. I love the oceans. I will, you know, kill to defend them, or I will destroy, you know, whatever to keep the ocean life pristine and healthy. You know, what am I willing to do? You know, my mind always goes to murder. And, you know, people who know me know that that's what my first instinct is just to kill people or kill things or, you know, destroy the thing that's bringing about my lack of peace. And I don't know, you know, other people may not see it that way. But, you know, whenever I just wish you were not here, I wish you didn't exist. I wish you were never born. Anything like that. I wish this never happened. Any wish for something to be completely eradicated from the universe is really a death wish. It is a desire to murder.
Doesn't that make the ego the ultimate vigilante then? Because basically it usurps what rightfully is God's function. To meet justice, and of course God has no cognizance of any kind of dream, so there is no punishment. But and the instant, you know, we get on the vigilante bandwagon, we're basically saying my function is now shifted from the student, the happy student, the happy learner that the Christ within us has appointed. Instead, is now we've taken it over, and now we become the jailer. And when we lock somebody up, guess where the jailer is? The jailer's, you know, the prison guard is also in prison. He may be on the other side of the bars, but they're both in prison. And so if we see a politician on TV that we find distasteful or some event or some situation, whether it's under our own roof or across the planet or wherever, if it's something that pushes our buttons, that's a clue that we've got some forgiveness work to do. We need to bring those perceptions back into our mind with our inner kindness teacher, look at them together, because together, you know, as the Course says, we have a light that will dispel the darkness, the light being the letting people off the hook, you know, not in terms of behavior, not in terms of form, but in terms of where it's really important, which is our identity, and recognizing that, you know, this perfect spirit appears to have taken these incredibly whacked out forms, including this one I call Bruce and another one called Lynn, and but there's nothing wrong with those. In truth, those beliefs are no more consequential than a cartoon character and what a cartoon character does or doesn't do to the reality that's, you know, that's completely intact, and the innocence that has never been scathed by anything that dream figures have done or cartoon characters have done. So.
Exactly. And what, you know what I notice about cartoon characters? I watch a lot of them with my grandson and kids. Is, you know, whatever terrible thing happens to them in one cartoon, the next cartoon, they're perfectly fine. They don't even remember that that happened. There's no continuation.
Serious rebound skill and the ultimate stunt double, huh?
Yeah, exactly. Tom and Jerry are always just, you know, perfect no matter what. They blew each other up or dropped anvils on their heads or whatever. They always come
infinite up. Lives.
Yep. And it's the same story over and over and over again, and that's all we are, cartoon characters, infinite lives over and over and over. But it's not infinite, thank God for that, because there is only a certain amount of foolishness that we're allowed, and Jesus tells us that our tolerance for pain is great, but it's not infinite. Exactly. So you realize this is insane and painful, then, you know, that's the time to get out. So I'm going to continue with the reading. When you react at all to errors, you are not listening to the Holy Spirit. He has merely disregarded them. And if you attend to them, you are not hearing him. If you do not hear him, you are listening to your ego and making as little sense as the brother whose errors you perceive. This cannot be correction. It is more than merely a lack of correction for him. It is the giving up of correction in yourself. When a brother behaves insanely, you can heal him only by perceiving the sanity in him. If you perceive his errors and accept them, you are accepting yours. If you want to give yours over to the Holy Spirit, you must do this with his. Oh, and I just wanted to hold on to those because they're so juicy. Oh, my gosh. Do I really have to let go of all this? Oh, no. Okay.
At our own pace, in our own time, right?
Unless this becomes the one way in which you handle all errors, you cannot understand how all errors are undone. How is this different from telling you that what you teach, you learn? Your brother is as right as you are, and if you think he is wrong, you are condemning yourself. You cannot correct yourself. Is it possible, then, for you to correct another? Yet you can see him truly because it is possible for you to see yourself truly. It is not up to you to change your brother, but merely to accept him as he is. And what am I accepting? A couple things I think, you know, when Jesus is asking me to accept. First off, that this is a character in a dream, and however the character behaves in the dream has no consequence to the truth and reality of what I am. So I might as well accept it. And, you know, just like you accept the characters in the movie doing the things they do. You know, I mean, there are some of us, like me, who say to the character in the movie, hey, don't do that. That's not right. Oh, don't go there. Don't open that door. You know, but but the character in the movie is going to do what they do no matter what I say or what I think is right or good or should be done. To judge the actor and say, man, are you ever stupid? You meet, you know, Brad Pitt on the street and you say, God, I just can't believe you did some of the stupid stuff you did in this movie or that movie. That's not who he is. It's not who they are. And so when we look at our brother and we see and accuse them of being the character and doing actions, which we know the script is written, the character has nothing to say about their actions. The character has nothing to say about the script. It's already there. It's coded in. So, you know, you can't blame the character for the script. You can't blame the Christ and assume that the Christ has taken a step down to become this actor in this or this character in the script. The Christ has done nothing. It remains exactly as it always has been. But we are perceiving it through our own flawed egoic perception, our own egos. We're perceiving, we're projecting the character on the screen. The light is always there. But the projection is the form we see. Anyway, okay. So you cannot correct yourself. Is it possible then for you to correct another? Yet you can see him truly because it is possible for you to see yourself truly. It is not up to you to change your brother, but merely to accept him as he is. His errors do not come from the truth that is in him, and only this truth is yours. His errors cannot change this and have no effect at all on the truth in you. To perceive errors in anyone and to react to them as if they were real is to make them real to you. You will not escape paying the price for this, not because you are being punished for it, but because you are following the wrong guide and will therefore lose your way. Your brother's errors are not of him any more than yours are of you. But that's hard to take, that these errors aren't mine or his. But accept his errors as real, and you've attacked yourself. If you would find your way and keep it, see only truth for you and walk together. The Holy Spirit has in you forgives all things in you and in your brother. His errors are forgiven with yours. Atonement is no more separate than love. Atonement cannot become separate because it comes from love. Any attempt you make to correct a brother means that you believe correction by you is possible. And this can only be the arrogance of the ego. correction is of God, who does not know of arrogance. God, who does not know of sin. God, who does not know of error. God, who does not know of darkness. That's, God doesn't know about this stuff. And to be correct is to return our minds to that original thought. The Holy Spirit forgives everything because God created everything. Do not undertake his function, or you will forget yours. Accept only the function of healing in time, because that is what time is for. God gave you the function to create in eternity. You do not need to learn that, but you do need to learn to want it. For all that learning was made. This is the Holy Spirit's use of an ability that you do not need, but that you made. Give it to him. You do not understand how to use it. He will teach you how to see yourself without condemnation by learning to look on everything without it. This is how he's teaching us to see without condemnation, by learning to look on everything without it. Condemnation will then not be real to you, and all your errors will be forgiven. Wow.
Yep.
Yep.
Good stuff.
Good
huh?
stuff, huh?
Shall I press on?
Sure. Any thoughts on that? I mean, it seems pretty clear to me, but boy, I guess I could have this, like, tattooed on my arm or something.
And I think this is just a further example of how, you know, the emphasis in A Course in Miracles is always on our relationship to everyone and everything, because of the nature of how extensively we've projected everything and how we need to, you know, own all those projections, not necessarily to try to change what seems to be happening seemingly outside of ourselves, but to recognize that our interpretation is really where, you know, we can make the most change by dropping ego's interpretation and allowing the Holy Spirit's interpretation that innocence really is, you know, warranted and true for everyone, not based on behavior or on form of any kind, but based on the eternal spirit that we all really are. So anyway, it's very important.
Yeah.
And we have countless classrooms in which to practice that forgiveness exercise, don't we?
Yeah. Yeah, and it seems like now for me there's a lot. So I think
it's because the more we become aware, the more we see how extensive that insanity is, and then therefore the need to you know turn it over to that awareness within us that does know how to undo the insanity by not condemning, and by seeing through the form to the reality behind it, past the special of, past the special hate, to the truth that is pristinely, eternally innocent within everyone. So
that's beautiful. So go ahead and carry on. We have about 10 more minutes.
Okay. Persa says, thank you, Gary. So as you can see, it's not your function to correct errors. It's your function to overlook them. Do not make them real. And once again, forgive what your brother has not done. But the ego has a different idea. As the Course puts it, the ego too has a plan of forgiveness because you are asking for one, though not of the right teacher. The ego's plan, of course, makes no sense and will not work. By following its plan, you will merely place yourself in an impossible situation to which the ego will always lead you. The ego's plan is to have you see error clearly first, then overlook it. Yet how can you overlook what you have made real? By seeing it clearly, you have made it real and cannot overlook it. So basically you have to back up and look at the very premise for, you know, how do we look on illusion? Do we look at it on our own or with that inner guidance that doesn't see a sin but merely error? Gary, I get it. So if I make it real, I can't forgive it. So it's like I have to have the attitude that it's not real right from the start. It's that state of miracle readiness the Course talks about. You know, once in a while I get an email from somebody who isn't happy about something, or someone will post something rude on the internet. There are a lot of angry people out there, and the internet is the perfect place for them to project their unconscious guilt. And they'll explain very carefully what I've done wrong and how I'm a greedy, terrible person, not that they know me or ever met me. And they'll get very clear about what my problem is. And then at the end of the email or posting, they'll often say, "Oh, but I forgive you." Exactly. And they've spent so much time making it real, they don't understand they're not forgiving you. That's a classic ego trap, and the ego is very good at setting it. For example, your whole society is based on making things real through analysis. Many of your professions engage in it, including yours and countless others, engineers, doctors, lawyers, scientists, physicists, stock market traders. But that analysis makes everything firmly real to the mind. Now, I'm certainly not saying you shouldn't analyze things, if that's part of your job. What I'm saying is that you want to be aware of it so you don't get trapped into making it real. What you want to do is replace your belief in illusions with the belief in the truth. And as you know, in the Course, the word light means truth. In fact, Jay asks you at one point, can you find light by analyzing darkness, as the psychotherapist does, or like the theologian, by acknowledging darkness in yourself and looking for a distant light to remove it while emphasizing the distance?
That's insane.
Well, Persa, obviously the answer is no. That's why the Course's kind of forgiveness, which you described so succinctly, overlooks the problem, doesn't make it real, and replaces it with the truth. Yes, you have to notice what it is you're forgiving. You're operating within the ego framework where healing is needed. And as long as you appear to be here, you will see other bodies, and it will look like you have real problems, real bills to pay, and real relationships to forgive. But if you forgive them, they'll stop making you feel anxious, abandoned, lacking, or any of the other negative impacts these things may have on you.
So. Yeah, and I think that's really, honestly, it is a step-by-step thing, because sometimes these things just seem so huge and overwhelming. And I think, like you said, you know, when you start looking at them, they become even bigger for me because of all the details that I add into them. And so when Jesus is talking about analyzing, the whole idea of analyzing the darkness is really looking and trying to find a reason for it, trying to find a proof or evidence of, you know, why it is real, or, you know, what's backing this up, what's making this exist. And I see people doing that. I've done it myself with, even the Course, you know, trying to analyze it and go into it and say, well, he must mean this and this must mean that and this must come together. And now we have this new edition where we're talking about, well, there are other things he might be, you know, meaning or thinking about or having said to us or whatever. And instead of practicing forgiveness, we're analyzing things to death. We're looking for reasons why they do exist. And forgiveness just says, there is not a single basis for any single one of these. There, you know, you can back it all the way as far as you can analyze it all you want. And what you're going to find out, just like with the physical world, you can analyze the physical world to the end, and what you come up with is a bunch of empty space. Small particles of light and energy and empty space. There's nothing there. When you uh-huh. go digging uh-huh. into it, you come to there's nothing there.
Exactly.
And that's proper analysis of bringing you to a point where it doesn't exist. But the analysis we do is coming up with reasons why it's true, why it exists, why this works, why this happened. And there's no reason.
I have a colleague that is interested in the topic of sacred geometry, which is something I've studied over the years, and his name's Nassim Haramein. I heard him talk once and gave a really interesting talk, sharing about how in grade school he learned that, you know, 0, 1, and 2 dimensions are all kind of mental exercises, as are things above 3 dimensions, 4th dimension, 5th dimension. We can't actually experience those directly, but we can symbolize them. We can make things that represent them. What he was sharing is that when he was in grade school, and his teacher said, well, only 3-dimensional things are real. And his commentary was, what makes them real? you know, why aren't one and two dimensional or four and five dimensional things real? And then he, you know, kind of further emphasizes it's like it, if you go down to the smallest particles, you know, subatomic, you know, there's no distance there. So they either have infinite density or there's nothing there, or, you know, it's, all these little conundrums come up that are just, you know, can't be solved in terms of common sense, basically, that, you know, matter and mass, you know, it's like that. Well, they're ideas. It's only because the whole material universe is really just an idea, and it's an insane idea. But we don't see that from within it. We have to go beyond, you know, kind of as Einstein said, outside the scope of the problem, which is the problem that ego set up. Not that that was what Einstein said specifically, but, you know, extrapolating to what, of course, Miracles would suggest is that, you know, we can only solve the ego problem from above the battleground or outside the ego thought system, because within it, it's foolproof. But Holy Spirit says, nah, but it's not God-proof. So we have to, you know, we have to just look at the dream, the fabric of the dream space together with Holy Spirit and see that doesn't mean we don't, you know, do the normal things and, you know, brush your teeth and drive to your job and get groceries and all, you know, all the usual stuff. But we don't have to take it seriously. And the more we kind of look at the insanity of the interpretations of the ego, and see how crazy those are, the more we'll want to choose from our own incentive, our own desires to see peace instead of those crazy interpretations. And, you know, it's a long, process typically, but that's actually more comforting than having the blinders, you know, abruptly yanked off of our our face. You know, that would be, as of course points out, is that'd be more fearful because we're not used ready for that. But if we can slowly learn to generalize and forgive and practice that process of looking at the insanity of the ego thought system without condemnation in ourselves or each other, then we begin to experience the peace that is beyond the special love, special hate, condemnation game that the ego makes up. And experiencing that peace more and more, we feel the contrast. And we seem to, like you say, we were talking about a moment ago, we seem to notice that it gets crazier, but it's really just the craziness that's been there all along. We're just paying more attention to it. We're just seeing that's, you know, been there all along, and now we're ready to, you know, more and more consistently choose against it. So
exactly, absolutely. And so that's, you know, that's what we're doing here. We're learning to, you know, choose again. And
yep.
That's pretty much the whole point of A Course in Miracles, is choose again. So thank you, Bruce. I appreciate
it. Thank you, Lynn.
On Saturday morning and hanging
Likewise.
Out with me. And look forward to talking to you next week. And I did set the I'm on page 138, and I did set my marker there. So we'll start back again on The Lifetimes When Jesus and Buddha Knew Each Other, A History of Mighty Companions, next week.
Sounds great. Thanks so much.
All right.
Have a great week, all.
Bye.
Bye for now.